afternoon. I'm going to call the third case for the April arguments, 98-2487BA, in the matter of the Bar Admission of Nicholas Thomas Sagansky. Mr. Gordon E. McQuillan representing Mr. Sagansky. Mr. McQuillan.
May it please the court, I am Gordon McQuillan, and I do represent the applicant, Thomas Nicholas Sagansky. Mr. Sagansky is here because the Board of Bar Examiners has declined to certify to this court that he has demonstrated the requisite character and fitness under Supreme Court Rule 40.06, as determined by the Board of Bar Examiners applying its own rule, BA 6.03, parentheses G and parentheses H, to be admitted to the practice of law in Wisconsin. One of the major problems that Mr. Sagansky brought to the attention of this court in his briefs is that the Board of Bar Examiners did not demonstrate that it had considered all of the factors set forth in BA 6.03 A through I. Rather, it applied, according to its own record, only two of those standards. It is, of course, tempting to presume that the board did do the balancing contemplated by the rule, and certainly in its briefs to this court, the board now asserts that it did consider such factors as Mr. Sagansky's age at the time that he engaged in certain conduct, the recency of that conduct, the reliability of the information that was supplied to the board concerning the conduct, the seriousness of the conduct per se, and any mitigating circumstances surrounding the conduct. However, the record is devoid of any such evidence that the board did undertake those considerations. The board also made no showing in its record as to the materiality of any supposed omissions or misrepresentations in Mr. Sagansky's applications for not only admission to practice law in the state, but perhaps more importantly, in his application for admission to the University of Wisconsin School of Law. In fact, the board expressly said that Mr. Sagansky failed to display candor during the admissions process. Contrary, though, to the board's apparent understanding of the term, candor means unreserved, honest, or sincere expression. Thus, when the board in its decision faults Mr. Sagansky for the manner in which he answered its questions, it is not his candor with which the board finds fault, but the nature of his answers per se. The problem that Mr. Sagansky faces in presenting his case to this court is that there is no indication anywhere in the record as to the weight given by the board to any of the criteria set forth in the rule. So it might be the case that Mr. Sagansky was this close to being certified, or he may have been this far away. We don't know.
This is as good as a mile.
I understand that, but it doesn't help future applicants to know where the mark is. If they attempt to hit that mark, they may miss it by as much or as little as Mr. Sagansky and never know it.
Did you ask for a hearing?
We did.
And it was denied?
It was denied.
What good would a hearing have done you before the board?
Well, a hearing would have done the following things. First, it would have allowed Mr. Sagansky to present evidence that was contrary to the material that was supplied by police reports. Now, police reports contain a lot of information that is second and third-hand hearsay from persons present at the scene of the conduct. What it doesn't contain, what they don't contain, is very much from Mr. Sagansky. So when Mr. Sagansky now presents to the board his version of events, he is viewed by the board as somehow, in the board's own terms, minimizing his own conduct. Had he been able to go and present evidence and have other persons who were present say what would happen at the event, I don't think that the board would have thought that he was being disingenuous. Remember, it's not the conduct per se that the board found objectionable, but his version of events and the fact that he tried to minimize his conduct.
Counselor, I continue to read in various places that it's not the conduct, but it is his version. It's the it's what's on the application, if you will. And yet in reviewing the findings of fact and conclusions of law which form the basis for the Board of Bar Examiners finding, number two of the conclusions states the applicant's unlawful conduct and incomplete and untruthful disclosure are relevant to his character and fitness.
I don't disagree with that. My point is that we don't know what they mean.
Mr. McQuillan, you're going to have to stand.
We don't know what they mean when they say something other than the conduct. He has never denied engaging in the conduct.
I mean, a reading of number two of the conclusions is that incomplete and untruthful disclosure was part of the relevant to his character and fitness, and also his unlawful conduct. And yet, referencing unlawful conduct seems inconsistent with the statement that you just made, that the board was operating just on the nature of the answers and responses. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I understand exactly what you're saying. There's conduct and then there's conduct. Mr. Sagansky had said he was provoked during the incident at a tavern on State Street in 1995.
Let me be more specific. Is it your understanding that the board, in reaching its determination, relied on the underlying convictions and charges with regard to drinking and maybe marijuana and too much noise?
I don't know, and neither do you, because the board doesn't say.
How do you interpret this conclusion that the applicant's unlawful conduct is relevant to his character and fitness?
I would interpret that to mean it's relevant, but when it's conjoined with incomplete and untruthful disclosures, I don't know which of those three things was the cause of the board determining that he could not satisfy the character and fitness requirement.
It could be any one or all of them.
It could be. It might not be.
Well, why don't we see if we can't isolate it, because then Mr. Lee might respond in the same manner. The findings of fact, and I'm reading from your appendix, page 101. The findings of fact of the board are that he didn't satisfy the requirements as set forth in SCR. And that's a conclusion, and the finding of fact is, one, he received at least five citations for alcohol violations, at least two for noise, and one for disorderly conduct from housing authorities while resident in the UW-Madison dorms. Ian disclosed but one to the UW Law School. Okay, so let's just separate out. Suppose that, what year was that?
1991.
Okay.
No, I'm sorry, Karen. Those were before 1991.
Okay. All right, he was an undergraduate.
He was an undergraduate.
So,
and if I may, the only reason the board became aware of those is because he told them about them. They are nowhere in anyone's records any longer. The housing authority destroys those records when a student graduates.
All right. And so let us assume he had in pre-1991 five citations for alcohol, two for noise, and one for disorderly conduct. And these are all citations from the UW Housing Authority.
Correct.
Is it your position that those alone would not justify keeping him out of the bar?
I think those clearly,
that is the
they would not keep him out of the state bar based upon the criteria in the rule.
Okay. Now, it then says that he disclosed only one to the UW Law School. Is that true?
It's absolutely true, because that's all that the law school asked him.
What did the law school ask him?
Well, again, the law school application form is also in the appendix.
Okay. And?
132 and the following pages.
Okay. All right. So, what does it ask?
If you look at 5A, at Petitioner's Appendix 134, it says, have you ever been dropped, suspended, expelled, placed on probation, or otherwise disciplined by any college, university, or law school for academic or other reasons? And the answer is yes, he was placed on probation, exactly as the law school asks. The rest of those did not constitute discipline in any sense by the university.
Citation is not discipline? He says he received at least 5 citations for alcohol violations, 2 for noise, and 1 disorderly conduct.
They are not disciplined anywhere that we could find the definition of the term.
Okay, so what was the and he was placed then for a minor fist fight, and was that come under B?
That's under A, as you, if you look down to the handwritten information, because he does say yes.
Oh, sorry. We're under the findings of fact. 3A, B, C, or D, does the fist fight come under?
I don't know.
Okay, that's what I'm trying to...
I think it's 1 citation for disorderly conduct, but I don't know.
Okay.
The board doesn't say which they're relying on.
All right. Okay, but it may be under A.
It may be.
Maybe, but it's not.
There's a C, too.
Let's see what C says. C, disorderly conduct at a bar in 1995 where he threatened a police officer. Was he in the dorms then?
No, he was not.
Okay, so it couldn't be C.
It's not C.
Okay. All right. Now, so we're done with A. You say that he disclosed the one that was required to be disclosed in 5A, right?
Correct.
And that's your position. Okay, B. The applicant on October 91 received 21 citations for furnishing alcohol or beverages to underage persons charged with possession of marijuana, pleading no contest, and being convicted of reduced charges of 3 counts of furnishing alcoholic beverages. Now, that is several years before he applies for admission. Is it your position, let us assume he did all that, is it your position that if that were all true, that he should be kept out of the bar?
He should not, again, because if you apply all of the factors in the bar, the Board of Bar Examiners rules, if you look at the recency of conduct, the age at the time of the event, the number of incidents involved. Remember, it says 21 citations, but it was a single incident.
Now, does that come into 5B? Have you ever been convicted or pled guilty or no contest to or forfeited bail for any criminal conduct under law or ordinance?
It does, although
that's
he notes...
That's not criminal conduct.
It was civil citations, so he disclosed it even though he was not required to. Now, I should point out that the new application for admission to the law school does ask for civil violations as well.
Okay, so he says he was fined $2,000 as one of 5 involved in parties. He doesn't say that, what about the marijuana? Was that a civil offense too?
That was also civil.
Okay.
They were all ordinance violations.
Okay. But he doesn't say marijuana. He says for an underage beer party, so... He doesn't say it was involved with alcohol beverage violation either. It's just an underage beer party. Okay.
He does indicate he was fined, however.
Right.
Was there any conviction on the marijuana charge?
No.
It was all under an ordinance of possession?
It was all under ordinance, yes.
Okay. All right, now we get to see. The applicant was convicted of disorderly conduct arising out of an altercation in a bar. Now it's much more recent, right?
It is.
August 29th, during which incident he threatened a police officer. Well, what about a disorderly conduct with an altercation at a bar within 2 years? He's in law school now, right?
Correct.
All right, where does that show on his application form? it won't show. This was when he applied, is that right?
That's correct.
Does he have to make a change in the form when he finishes law school? He doesn't have to make revelation of anything that occurred during law school?
I misunderstand you.
Does he have to reveal to the law school any activities that raise questions about his character and fitness?
Not to the law school.
Not to the law school. He does that to BBE when he applies.
Correct. And he does that. Petitioner's Appendix 144, he lays out the incident.
All right.
Also at that page, he goes into great detail about all of the citations that he received at the underage drinking party, including possession of marijuana and the 21 charges.
Okay, that's under 25C.
Correct. One of the things I do want to point out about that as well, the way these things work is the police say, who wants the citations? They don't hand one citation for each offense to each person who was at the residence. They say, who wants them? He got them.
So he volunteered?
He volunteered. If he hadn't volunteered, he wouldn't have had any citations.
Why did the police do that?
The police do that because they want to break up underage drinking parties. It's not their goal to create a criminal record for any of these students at the university. They simply want, that's what I derived from the fact that they operated in the manner that they did. They don't want to create criminal records for young people at the university. They want the drinking parties not to occur. And we do that by fining them, as you pointed out, $2,000, a substantial sum to an undergraduate student.
Well, I assume you agree that the BBE can, looking at this record, make a determination that he threatened a police officer.
That I disagree with, and the reason I disagree with that is because he wasn't charged with that. The Board of Bar Examiners, operating on their own, drew that conclusion. The citations he received were not for threatening a police officer.
Well, there must have been a report that said threatening.
There was a report in which he said, I'm a law student, I'm going to make this the worst day of your life. He certainly didn't threaten the police officer with bodily harm or in any way resist the officer. In fact, he was the one who called the police to the disorderly because he thought that he had been the one who had been assaulted.
Okay. D, the applicant explained all incidents in a manner which denied or minimized his culpability or responsibility for them. And his rendition of the facts of the 1995 incidents is so at variance with all other contemporaneously statements as to be incredible. What do you have to say about that?
What I have to say about that is the only statements that were included were the two statements from police officers, which don't contain any statements from any of the witnesses. All they contain is brief summaries of what witnesses, including those who were interested on the other side of the altercation, told the police officers. There was never any kind of a hearing, no means of determining who was the more credible, which a police officer's report does not typically do. It simply turns over the information to the prosecution.
If you had had a hearing before BBE, what would you have done other than oral argument?
I think the most important thing would have been to show that Mr. Sagansky was not minimizing his conduct, that he was explaining it. Ralph Waldo Emerson said of one individual that he knew the louder he defended his honor, the faster we counted the spoons. Mr. Sagansky could have come and not had to repeatedly give written responses, but could answer the questions put to him by the Board of Bar Examiners. This is a peculiar process that goes on over there because someone reviews the document and sends out requests for additional information. If they don't get the additional information they're looking for, they send out another request. It makes it appear as though the applicant is somehow being less than candid because they're answering the questions they're being asked. It's as though the applicant is supposed to somehow apprehend what it is that the Board of Bar Examiners investigators is seeking and yet they're given a specific question to answer. It's almost like trying to figure out what the questioner is asking. There's no indication of how broad the answer is. There's no indication in what great detail. It's interesting, one of the last items in my appendix is the current law school application and the caveat from the dean of the law school. And what the dean of the law school has to say, and I don't know if he was trying to be tongue-in-cheek, it's at Petitioner's Appendix 175. If later you apply for admission to the Bar of Wisconsin, you will be asked to fill out an application form with questions like number 5, but that go into much more detail. Now, to me, that responds to the very question that the Board of Bar Examiners put to Mr. Sagansky, why he didn't give thorough answers. And the answer is because the law school doesn't ask those questions. Even now, they're saying, give us the information that we asked for, but be wary of the fact that the Board of Bar Examiners is going to ask for more detailed information. The second paragraph, the first sentence of the second paragraph is also enlightening. This caveat is not intended to discourage you because of minor youthful peccadilloes. Now, I don't know what that means exactly, but I think it means the same thing as the Board of Bar Examiners rule that talks about the age of the applicant at the time of the occurrence, the recency of the occurrence, that sort of thing.
Now, your client graduated from law school when?
I'm sorry, I don't know exactly.
96. And we're now into 98. So if he graduated in June...
We're actually
99. Thank you very much. Time moves quickly when you're having fun. That's 2 years, right?
3 years.
3 years.
Incidentally, if he had applied as soon as he graduated, he would have fallen under the old rules and would never have to answer these questions in the first place.
Well, would the law school have permitted him to, would the law school have given him the seal of good housekeeping?
I don't know. They gave no indication that they would not.
Okay. But it's not applicable because we're under these new rules. I see.
Right.
All right. So he's been out for 3 years. What's he been doing? I know it's not part of the record, but why don't you tell us anyway?
Well, oddly enough, he's employed primarily as a bouncer in a tavern, and that's why his focus on the disorderly conduct was on the conduct of the bouncers at the bar whom he thought had roughed up a couple of young women. And that's why he called the police. And the irony is, of course, that he ended up being cited and not the bouncer. And candidly, it's a municipal citation. He's not going to spend hundreds and hundreds of dollars to contest a municipal citation. He's going to pay the fine as probably 99.9% of people do and move on with life, never understanding that somehow this was going to be a permanent bar to carrying on his career.
What is it exactly that you want us to do?
Well, I want you to do two things. The one that's of greater importance to me as a practitioner with a tiny niche market of people coming saying, I've been denied admission to the bar, is set some standards that are discernible for applicants. The simple words that are set out in the bar, Board of Bar Examiners rules about the recency of conduct, the age, etc., don't help a lot, nor do the broad terms of character and fitness, which, as I understand this from reading cases, no one has ever actually defined, and perhaps rightly so, because they are ill-definable. But that doesn't mean that there isn't some way. We looked at the cases that have come before you previously. They involve people who were lied about having been in prison when they got their law degree. There were people who lied about possessing handguns and sufficient quantities of drugs to constitute felonies for which they had been convicted in their prior state. Things like that that they had failed to disclose. On the other hand, there's a series of cases involving drugs and alcohol, and I noticed that the summary of the case that's distributed for passers-by sort of indicates that that's what this case is about. But we tried to suggest to the Board of Bar Examiners that if that was their concern, then they should let us know, because we will come to you with some evidence of assessment and rehabilitation, if need be, of this applicant. But they denied that they were interested in that aspect of it. And in fact, if you look at their decision, nowhere does it mention anything about drugs and alcohol other than as factors in the disorderly conduct. But we don't find any cases where the kind and degree of inappropriate civil misconduct that Mr. Sagansky engaged in has acted to prevent someone from being admitted to the bar.
Are you asking to go back before the BBE and have another hearing? Is that what you like also?
Well, that's tempting, but it's the board has already made its decision. I don't know without guidance from this body.
Well, that's why I say if standards are set, then
that would be helpful. The alternative, of course, is to do what the court has done in some instances, and that is to not defer to the board, which is the court has said it need not do, and instead certify Mr. Sagansky directly.
You've also said come back in a year sometime.
Well, we suggested that as well, and I think the board properly responded. It's already been more than a year. So now what would we do if we come back in a year? It's already been more than a year since he began applying.
What's the record in the last 3 years?
In terms of any misconduct, there's nothing since 1995. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McQuillan. You'll have some time for rebuttal. Justice Prosser? No? Attorney Lee, representing the Board of Bar Examiners.
May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General Alan Lee, representing the Board of Bar Examiners. Excuse me. The facts in the case are undisputed. There's absolutely no dispute of fact here. We all agree on the standard of review, whether the Board's conclusions were proper. It's an unusual case where everyone agrees on the facts and the applicable standard of law. The only issue, the issue for this Court, the same issue that was before the Board of Bar Examiners, is with whether Mr. Sagansky meets the requirements of this court's Rule 40.06. In other words, whether Mr. Sagansky exhibits the qualities of character and fitness needed to assure the integrity and competence of services performed for clients and the maintenance of high standards in the administration of justice. When considering this question, the court does not defer to the board, but it reviews the board's conclusions, mindful of the board's experience in administering the court's rules on admission. Of course, the burden of proving character and fitness always, always remains with the applicant. In this case, the board was concerned with the petitioner's past conduct, but was more concerned with his consistent minimizing of his responsibility for that conduct. For example, in response to a law school admission question on whether he was ever placed on probation or otherwise disciplined, he answered yes. He was placed on housing probation for a minor fistfight. In response to the bar's admission question on a very similar question on whether he had been placed on academic probation or disciplined by a college, he revealed that he was disciplined by UW housing authorities and revealed not only the minor fistfight, which by then had become a shoving match, but he also revealed that he had received now a handful of citations for underage drinking and excessive noise. He minimized the misconduct by stating that the citations were given out frequently and, he thought, often inappropriately. In September of 1991, he co-hosted an underage drinking party and received 21 citations for furnishing alcoholic beverages to underage persons, and he was charged with possession of marijuana. He was at the door of the party. In a statement to the board about this incident, he did not say, "I was wrong." He did not say, "I exercised poor judgment." He did not say, "I shouldn't have done that." He said instead that the citations were based on a 21-year drinking age which he opposed, and received during Operation Sting, which he thought was unfair.
Well, don't you give any credit for honesty?
I think we give some credit for honesty, yes.
All right. Where does it say he's supposed to be contrite on the form?
I think that there's nothing that requires him in the rules or in the form to be contrite. But when you look at the whole picture here, it is not a question of not simply not being contrite. It's never taking responsibility for any of his actions. And I suggest there's a difference between not being contrite and not taking responsibility.
Well, he concedes that he engaged in unlawful distribution to minors, contrary to city ordinance. Right?
Yes, and I think he also seems to be saying that if you disagree with the law, you are free to violate it.
Well, you only have to agree to pay the fine. Well, it's really a forfeiture.
Well, yes, and I think at some point, if that is his view of civil disobedience, as it were, then you pay the piper.
Well, does the piper include the BBE?
I think at some point, not just that, those citations, but a series of those kinds of misconduct, and looking at the record as a whole, his explanations of the incidents as a whole, yes.
Well, suppose that he got a lot of parking tickets because he didn't pay the meter or parked in an unlawful spot and, paid the forfeiture. And he may do it, several times a week for several years. Does that mean this is a civil disobedience and you won't let him into the state park?
I'm tempted to give the easy answer, which is the form says you can ignore parking violations, but I know that is not the answer.
Well, I would just change it. I would make it a garbage violation.
Absolutely.
It didn't matter what I did.
I think it's
putting tin cans or aluminum cans into your non-recyclable trash.
I think at some point the board can consider that conduct. Is that in and of itself sufficient to say, no, you can't be a lawyer? I would think the board would say no and the court would agree.
Well, that's what I was going to get at. Now, suppose that we just go down the list. I really want to go down the list to see what the board, and maybe you can't respond to these questions, but suppose you had 5 violations pre-91 for alcohol violations, 2 for noise, 1 for disorderly conduct from housing authorities. Is that enough to keep you out of the bar?
I can't answer those questions, certainly on behalf of the board, and my personal opinion is absolutely irrelevant. But I think the board's decision makes it very clear that it was the whole record. It wasn't just the violations. It was the answers to the questions and the attitude expressed in those answers.
Do you think that he had to reveal all of these in his response? Doesn't ask you for that. It just asks if you've been on a discipline matter.
Well, in his answer...
And I can't evaluate it because I don't know what he was disciplined for at the university.
In his further explanation to the board, he talks about those earlier handful of citations for underage drinking as some sort of discipline.
I'm talking about alcohol violations. Was that because he furnished alcohol to an underage person too?
No. A are the housing violations.
Yes. There's some alcohol violations. Was that he drinking on university property?
Yes.
Okay.
And while he was underage, not
right.
Furnishing
okay.
to someone else.
All right. He disclosed but one.
He disclosed the, what do you call a minor fistfight?
Right.
To the law school. And he disclosed all of them and the fistfight to the Board of Bar Examiners.
Do you think he should have disclosed the others?
Yes.
Why? And under what?
In his, and I don't have the record cite in front of me, his response when he explained in more detail to the law school on those housing violations, he himself seemed to be referring to them as discipline. Certainly, if you receive a citation, it's not, it's not a reward. It's not an accolade. It's some kind of discipline.
Okay. All right. And B, he received 21 citations. You think that's adequate to keep him out of the bar?
Again, by itself, probably not.
Okay. So A by itself isn't enough. B by itself is not enough. What about C?
C is a much closer call. C is a very bad incident. The bouncer there told the police that he was shocked by the violence of the attack. Mr. Sagansky's brief to this court talks about that same incident as relatively benign conduct. He told the officer, quote, the petitioner said he was a fellow, that he was a law student, and he intended to make my life miserable. He stated he would do everything he could to make this the worst experience of my life. The petitioner does not deny that he said that. Doesn't deny that at all. And he has two responses to it. First of all, he said, well, there's nothing in the record that says that the officer took that as a threat. Well, how else was that meant? In an answer to my rhetorical question, the petitioner suggests, well, what I was actually doing, even though I regret those statements, was that I was saying I would challenge the citation. And his full answer to the board on this incident, I think, bears some repetition here. After saying, this is record page 32, that he did not stand by those statements, he then says, quote, I retract, regret, withdraw, and otherwise reject what I said there. I realize that what I said was stupid for a law student and would be totally inappropriate for a practicing lawyer. He then goes on, however, to say, I would like also like to explain exactly what I meant by that statement. My meaning was that I fully intended to challenge the citation in court as vigorously as possible because the officer's conclusions about the situation were grossly flawed. Additionally, as someone with some knowledge of the law, I could do so perhaps more effectively than a non-law student. I did not mean to imply that I would do anything illegal or grossly unethical.
Sounds contrite to me.
It sounds dissembling to me. And I think it sounds...
On which part? The first part sounds contrite. The second
and I think
tries to put a good face on it.
That's an interesting juxtapositioning because it seems to be the pattern that he exhibits. He admits and then he dissembles and minimizes and accepts, asks people to accept, to give him the credit for admitting the violations and to ignore his explanations and misrepresentations of them.
Let me tell you what's bothering me. The board now gets a lot of applications and has to do good moral character studies. My guess is about 700-800 a year. Do you know how many they really get?
I don't know offhand, but I would guess that's pretty close.
And I would guess that out of that 700 or 800, that very few raise problems. Maybe a handful, maybe two handfuls. And these are rather serious issues because here you have a young person who has spent a lot of years at college and three at law school. And now, in effect, is not able to practice law. And that is a very serious disadvantage to somebody who wants to be a lawyer. And I think that you read his responses with great meaning and read them well. But they could be read in a different tone, too. And therefore, an opportunity to see and hear a person is rather significant, especially since we agree that A alone might not be enough to justify keeping them out, and B alone might not be enough to justify keeping them out, and maybe even C alone
but not justify it. And I guess Robert Hansen wrote an opinion one time, and I guess it was a criminal case, that 0 + 0 + 0 = 0. But under the totality of the circumstances, maybe 0 + 0 + 0 = more than 0.
Correct.
And I'm wondering whether or not it is, and this body, this court, is not the place for a testimony, and it's not the place for a hearing on the merits. I think you'll agree with that.
Absolutely.
So would you think that the Board of Bar Examiners should give him an opportunity to be heard?
Well, under the court's rule, I think the board was precluded from hearing him.
Why is that?
The court's rule, 40.08, says the board shall grant a hearing to an applicant only upon a showing that there are facts bearing on the applicant's case that cannot be presented in writing. And in his letter to the board, he specifically said that wasn't the case. The board is then put in a very difficult situation. Is this a close case for the board? I suspect it was a close case for the board. Yes. Certainly no one is saying that this is the kind of conduct that should absolutely preclude someone from practicing law forever. That's not the suggestion. The Gaylord case, the court in very similar kinds of conduct decided that petitioner could reapply. Enough time had passed, mm-hmm. and that might cure it. In this case, it might be interesting to see if any different answers were forthcoming the third time around, as it were, to see if the applicant has learned something from what has to be a less than fun experience for him.
Mr. Lee, what the board, from what I gather, is saying here is that when you, and I think the chief has gone over this, that you look at A and B and C in this is singular, there may not be enough, but it's the perhaps the cumulative picture one gets of this applicant, and combined with his lack of, I don't want to say apparent full disclosure in or selectivity. Is that pretty much where the board is going, or you're trying to bring forth to us?
I think that aptly summarizes it. It is the totality of the circumstances. This is not some kind of mathematical formula that you can plug in and decide that if you get above a 5, you're in, and if you're below 5, you're out. These are judgment calls, and they are very difficult judgment calls. And the court has asked that board to make those difficult judgment calls. This court has a rule for practicing attorneys on candor and honesty when dealing with the courts. Is this the kind of candor and honesty that a court would accept from a practicing attorney? That raises an interesting issue. Should we at least expect that kind of candor in the application process? And I would expect the answer should be a resounding yes, at least that level of candor.
Now, what should the applicant have said here to get a hearing before the board?
I think he would have had to have said that he had facts that could not be presented in writing under the court's rule. And he was informed of that rule when the board wrote to him in its denial.
Tell me what kind of facts here, or even in a case you can imagine, that couldn't be presented in writing.
I find that difficult.
That's right.
To conjecture.
So is this in effect a rule that says no hearing before the board? Is it so that's something that maybe the court should look at?
It may end up being that, and the court might want to consider in rulemaking process giving the board some more discretion. I think the concern would be from the court, and I would guess historically from the board, is if every applicant on which the board has questions asks for a hearing, this is going to be a very time-consuming process.
Well, we just, and this I'm sure I can find out from the board's annual report, although there are many applications, I think there are relatively few, and I don't know the number, of people that the board refuses to admit, and that would might ask for a hearing.
Yes, that's true, but I think a discretionary or certainly a mandatory hearing raises some other problems.
But you don't even think this rule gives them discretion?
It doesn't seem to.
Is that how they administer this rule?
Pardon?
Is that how the board administers this rule?
I would think so, because that's certainly what the letter expressed going to this applicant, that unless there are facts that you cannot present in writing, you're not entitled to a hearing. But if the board grants this kind of hearing, just remember what the applicant was asking for here is not the kind of hearing where you present your version or different facts and ask a fact finder to determine whether the light was red or the light was green. What the applicant was asking for is another opportunity to lobby the board to again explain his conduct.
Well, do you consider oral argument lobbying?
It's certainly an opportunity to try to convince
and persuade,
sure. Yes.
Well, what's the matter with an applicant trying to persuade the board that the applicant is contrite and that what comes across in writing may not appear contrite, but that he really is? That he didn't view it that seriously then? If you view it seriously, I'm sorry.
First question that comes to my mind, is the board then entitled to or maybe required to try to find the officers and see exactly what was going on back then? Do we relitigate those cases?
Well, if the board is going to rely on the officer, maybe.
The board in the past, and this court, for example, in the Martin case, has made exactly those kind of, quote, credibility decisions based on the written record. Certainly, it's within the court's prerogative to change that rule. But up until this time, it has not, and I think the board is diligently following the court's direction.
Mr. Lee, let's assume for a moment that the majority of the court at least agrees with your position. Do you have any recommendations in regard to what kind of time period there ought to be before Mr. Sagansky could again apply, and whether or not there ought to be any conditions in the interim period?
I don't have any recommendations because those would be personal, and I hesitate to do that. I would only note that his application was denied just about a year ago, I think a year this month.
How long was it in process before it was denied?
Well, he applied in 19... He could.
My recollection was it took about a year.
I think it
could be wrong.
I believe it took a year, and then from the denial to now it took about a year.
And
so
what
about
from the petition to the denial? From the time he requested it?
Right.
It's
been about 2 years, I think, total.
It's 1 year through the board and 1 year through us.
Correct.
Roughly.
And I, to answer Justice Crook's question, I don't want to ignore that. I think the court's decision in Gaylord provides good guidance on what should be done. I think there should be a reapplication, and Mr. Sagansky and the board should look at the issues again. Mr. Sagansky, I think, should look inside himself and decide what went wrong here from his perspective. I think doing that, the board should then again look at Mr. Sagansky's application.
How can he change this past record?
I don't think it's simply the record itself, as I tried to suggest, that has made the whole difference. I think attitude has made a great difference here, and I think it is his attitude that came across in his writings that may well have tipped the balance.
Mr. Lee, you talk about this attitude and Mr. Sagansky's minimizing of his conduct. He's engaged a big-time law firm to come in here and minimize his conduct. Is that something to be held against him?
I would think not. No, I think he is entitled to argue that, given the record, he is entitled to be admitted. I think his time might have been better spent initially thinking about the answers to his application questions and thinking less about how he could appeal a denial.
Well, is there a difference between Mr. McQuillan minimizing his conduct and he himself minimizing his conduct?
Yes, I think there is. I think when you apply for admission to law school and apply for admission to the bar, you are asked to be candid. You are asked to be forthcoming. You are asked to err on the side of completeness and honesty. The advocate is given, even under this court's rules, some more general leeway on arguing the client's case and putting the best light in the client's case.
But he's supposed to have candor, too. Mr. McClellan.
And he also has the dual obligation of candor and advocacy for his client's cause.
Well, the client had a right of self-representation. Doesn't need a lawyer. I mean, he's constitutional right to represent himself, so doesn't he have a right both of candor and advocacy?
And I would note that I pointed out in my brief and in my argument some things in the brief itself to this court that bothered me about minimizing the conduct still. And I think the court can consider that. I don't think the fight outside of the bar is relatively benign conduct.
No, it's not. Fighting is nothing.
Is it a fight?
Yes, it was. Oh, most assuredly so.
Are you referring to the incident involving the bouncers?
The bouncer, yes.
Now, as I understand that, a fight, was that a fight with fisticuffs and all?
Yes, that's my understanding of it.
Shove.
Well, it was more than shoving. The bartender said he was surprised by the ferocity of the attack. And I would also point out that even though Mr. Sagansky walked down the street and flagged down a squad car, the bouncer had already called the police. And I don't have an awful lot of experience with bouncers, and I suspect the court has even less. But I suspect that it's the case that bouncers don't very quickly call the police because their employers don't want police coming to the bar because it puts their license at risk. The fact that the bouncer called the police, I think, is an important fact. It shows that the bouncer certainly didn't think this was your usual tussle in front of the pub on State Street on a Friday night.
So then it's your, I just want to make sure I understand this. Referring to page 134 of the petitioner's appendix.
I'll have to do this from memory. I forgot his appendix.
Have you ever been dropped, question A, have you ever been dropped, suspended, expelled, placed on probation, or otherwise disciplined? The answer to that, yes, that's correct, right? And then he said his explanation was he placed on housing probation for minor fist fight in a UW-Madison dorm in April of 91.
That was not the bar.
The altercation.
Wait, I know that. This was accurate. Was it, I assume this was it incomplete?
Yes. When he later reported to the board, he said there was that citation plus a handful of others.
Okay.
For underage drinking and excessive noise.
Well, he did mention the underage drinking in subsection B on page 134. He is fined $2,000 as one of five involved parties for an underage beer party.
No, that was a different incident. The ones I was talking about just now were housing violations that he received before the minor fistfight. Those were before roughly 1991. Then in 1991, he received the 21 citations pled in to those for having an underage beer drinking party at his house.
The
first underage citations were for his drinking underage. The ones you're talking about now were when he was of age and hosted an underage party.
Fisticuff will not show on this because this was an application to the law school before, as
yes.
In 93, and the fisticuff was 95.
It happened in his second year of law school.
So it won't show there. It will only show on the BBE.
Right. And then
the police
with respect to that, it's your claim that he minimized it or he wasn't totally truthful. He
absolutely.
Did talk about it, but he just didn't
correct.
Fess up completely.
And I think more so than the fight itself was the threat to the officer. I think that's in many ways more troubling than getting into a tussle outside of a bar. To then say, I'm a law student, watch it. One can imagine how people would react if someone said, I'm an assistant district attorney or I'm an assistant attorney general officer, you'd better not give me a ticket, I'll make your life a living hell. Or I'm a court of appeals judge, you can't arrest me.
Okay, and that was a criminal disorderly conduct?
It was a Madison ordinance violation.
That one was, okay.
Yes. There's no criminal conviction here, no.
Okay.
But that raises an interesting question. Is that the standard? Is that where the bar to the bar lies, that it must be criminal? I would hope that's not the case.
Well, but the reason you have an ordinance is that it's viewed as not as serious as criminal.
Correct. And certainly, I mean, This is not the kind of...
And the officer had a choice of doing a civil criminal action.
Oh, certainly. I would think, you know, depending on the officer's mood, the facts, and everything else, this could have been a battery.
Sure.
Absolutely true. I think the board has carefully and I think very conscientiously considered this application and has made a very difficult decision on, I think, what all of us agree is a close case. I think the court should affirm the board's conclusions. The standard here is whether those conclusions were proper. I think even if one might disagree with those conclusions, the conclusions based on this record are certainly proper. Whether the applicant should be allowed to reapply, leave to the court's good judgment. Unless there are further questions, thank you.
How long does it take to process an application?
I couldn't tell you. Mr. Rankin is here. I could ask him.
We can.
The process, upon the third of the application is less than 30 days. It also takes substantially longer than the application itself.
Mr. Rankin, just so we have it on the record,
yes. Answer to Justice Prosser's questions, a question that they have processed them in as little as 30 days, depends on exactly what's involved in the issue, but they can and have done them in as little as 30 days.
So the fact that this took a year might be due to more careful examination or at length by the IPB or delay by the applicant.
Or just being in line with a lot of other applicants and you take them as they come in the door, yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Mr. McQuillan?
Actually, we don't agree on the standard of review. The standard of review is broader than Mr. Lee says it is. It's not just the standard of whether the facts are as found by the Board of Bar Examiners, but in matter of bar admission of Roosh, this court went on to say that the court, after the findings are whether the findings are or not clearly erroneous, the court then determines whether the board's conclusions of law based on those facts are proper. And I think that throughout the brief of the Board of Bar Examiners, that part of the equation is never discussed. It focuses on the facts. It's interesting, if you look at finding of fact D, which is at page 3 of the record, I think that's a conclusion. I don't think that's a fact at all. But if it is a fact, then that is the very kind of fact that a hearing would have been useful in disposing of. And I do have to disagree with Mr. Lee's conclusion that the applicant did not request the hearing for anything meaningful, because at page 9 of the record, he notes everything that was in that explanation of the events in 1995 was factually accurate. The board may question my motivation on those occasions, but my motivation or my explanation for my conduct is neither a lack of candor, an omission, or misrepresentation. It's a difference of opinion. Because of the inherent ambiguities and some of the concerns, as you have articulated them, this is in the letter, the initial letter of denial, I request the hearing into these incidents during which the board can specifically address their concerns and I can be heard about those concerns. Now that is different than saying that there is nothing to be heard, and I think the question earlier about what kinds of facts would be presented at a hearing are exactly those kinds of facts. If finding the fact D is a finding of fact rather than a conclusion, then I think the questions from the justices about the advocacy role that an applicant in this kind of process, that is an application to be admitted to the bar, where else should you be able to go and advocate your position if not applying to the bar? And I think that's what the applicant had the right to do. I disagree with Mr. Lee that the board does not have the discretion. I think if the board can define facts as broadly as they did in this instance, they can certainly say, we're going to have a hearing in this case because we want to know what went on here. The matter of the minor fistfight is sort of interesting, and I did want to touch on that very quickly. The board says in its brief at page 9, Mr. Sagansky's information concerning his having been placed on housing probation, I quote, would lead the reader to believe, unquote, that he was placed on that probation for his participation in a single incident. There is no evidence whatsoever that that's not true. Mr. Sagansky said, I was placed on probation for this incident. Somehow the board doubts him. But there is not a shred of evidence anywhere in the record to engender that doubt. I think what that does is goes to show that, if you provide a snare to catch a rabbit, sometimes you'll catch something else. And I think that's what the board, in its eagerness to apply its own rules and to apply the process, decided that this person, as Mr. Lee says, was borderline. And maybe we ought to reject it. It's curious, Mr. Lee and I both agree on one thing, and that is that the rules could use some fine-tuning, or maybe even maybe broad tuning. The bigger question is, does Mr. Sagansky abide the results of that rulemaking and then reapply? I don't know what he does when he reapplies, because if he gets different answers, as the board's counsel suggests he should do, then he's going to be even more disingenuous and even further minimizing. I don't know how you can go back and fix the answers without being accused of giving different answers once again.
Yeah. Mr. McQuillan, on page 10 of the record, in his final paragraph, he refers to alcohol and other drug abuse, and that, although it's not stated in the board's findings, it certainly did come to my mind.
It came to our mind as well, and that's why we offered to present information. And the board, I don't recall whether overtly, but certainly covertly, in denying the request for a hearing, said that that was not their concern. And because there's nothing in the findings of fact to indicate that it was their concern, I think those two factors lead to the conclusion that it was not their concern.
Suppose that if there is alcohol or drug abuse here, let's just find a fact for the moment. What should the board do as to an admission?
Well, I think what the board should do in those kinds of instances is direct that the applicant go for an assessment, perhaps at an agency of the board's choosing, and have a determination as to whether there is alcohol or drugs. There are a number of cases where the board has suggested exactly, I'm sorry, where the court has suggested that's exactly what the applicant must do, that is engage in a program of rehabilitation and then reapply.